Turn to John chapter 8. This is the story of the woman taken in adultery. Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives, and early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. And the scribes and Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery, and when they had set her in the midst, they say unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery, in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned, but what sayest thou? This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he heard them not. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last, and Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had lifted up himself, and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee? She said, No man, Lord. And Jesus said unto her, Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. Notice that the woman is brought up for trial, so to speak, here in front of Jesus. And the Pharisees are not so concerned that the righteousness of God's law be fulfilled as they are simply using this woman caught in the act of adultery. They're using her in order to try to trap Jesus. But isn't it curious that the Pharisees brought forth a guilty woman? But what about the man who obviously had to have been caught in the act as well? Nothing is said about his part or his guilt in the situation. Why isn't he standing there on trial as well? Quite clearly, the Pharisees had a double standard, didn't they? Well, we're starting this message with this brief passage from the Gospel of John, not for the purpose of exegeting this passage, but because I simply want to use it as a launching text for some thoughts I would like to share with you, which includes the recent death of Princess Diana. In discussing her life and her tragic death, we're going to set forth what we believe to be the facts of her life and death, or some of them anyhow, obviously. But of course, it goes without saying that I did not know her personally, and neither did you. And so anything and everything that we know about her has come to us through the eyes of the TV cameras and the microphones and the newspapers of the modern scribes in the media. And we all know that these scribes, whom I've coined the term about 10 years ago to call them the media knights, we all know that the media knights mix truth with lies just as surely as politicians do. And thus, as I mention certain aspects of the life of Princess Diana, I wish to cast no stones at her personally. She was clearly a sinner. She admitted it publicly, and yet I ask each of us, who among us is without sin? Now, maybe you and I did not commit the same sins that she did, but the Epistle of James makes it clear that if we break the law in any one littlest part, we are guilty of breaking the whole law before God, are we not? And we notice in the story of the woman caught in adultery that Jesus did not say, Let him who is without the sin of adultery cast the first stone. He said, Let he that is without sin, period, let him first cast a stone at her. So we did not have to walk in Diana's shoes or her fairy tale slippers, shall we say. We did not face the challenges that she faced, and we did not have to confront them with the physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional gifts that she possessed or perhaps did not possess with which to confront her challenges. So although some of Diana's sins were there for the world to see, thanks to the vultures of the Midianites, I don't condemn her. I don't know all the facts, and I certainly don't know her heart. God does, and He alone can judge her justly. I say all this as prefatory because the thoughts I want to share with you are more in the manner of seeing Diana as a type or a symbol, and because I believe that her sudden demise had tremendous spiritual, almost prophetic significance. And I hesitate to use the word prophetic significance because I do not mean by that that her death was necessarily fulfilling any specific Bible prophecy, nor that her death is specifically prophetic of something future to happen. I'm not saying that. But I mean that in terms of types and symbols and shadows and so forth. And as I said, my remarks here are not meant to judge her personally, but in the course of presenting to you what I have found of significance in her death, it is necessary that I mention some of the bad as well as some of the good things that she did. Let's now go back in our minds to the time when we, the public, first became aware of this woman, Diana, when the world was first smitten by this shy little kitten called Diana. Remember when we first started hearing about her, she was 19 years old, I think, in 1980 or so, and she was a kindergarten teacher's aide in London. Remember that? And it seemed like a real-life Cinderella story coming to pass before our eyes. Here was the handsome prince, or at least some women must have thought he was handsome. Anyhow, he selects this woman from out of the depths of London, so to speak, this kindergarten teacher's aide, and he picks her to be his bride. The fairy tale theme of the Cinderella story where the prince marries the commoner, or so I thought at the time. Didn't you? Well, it wasn't quite that way. As we all learned last weekend, if we followed the funeral coverage on television or radio, how many of you did cover that or follow that to some extent? Come on.
Hard to miss.
All right. It's hard to miss, exactly. Well, as we all learned from that coverage, the Spencer family is an old English aristocratic family. That beautiful estate we saw at Althorp, England, where she is now buried, has been in that Spencer family, her family, for about 500 years. That takes us back to the late 1400s, about the time when Christopher Columbus was first discovering America. This was an English nobility family. It would also have been very close to the time that the English Cecil family dynasty was getting its start, too. You might remember from our Bible versions series that the Cecil family has been the dominant family behind the British monarchy since the time of Queen Elizabeth I in the 1500s. And you might also recall that the very glitzy and opulent Biltmore Estate in Asheville, North Carolina, is now owned by William Amherst Vanderbilt Cecil of that same English Cecil family. And Prince Charles and William Cecil know each other quite well, having thrown parties for each other when they visit the other's estates. And as I also believe I pointed out previously, I found it very intriguing that there at the Biltmore Estate, up on a high place, up on a hill in front of the 265-room mansion, the Biltmore Mansion, up in a grove of very tall trees on that hill, there is a life-size statue of the goddess Diana, with bow in hand, overlooking, as it were, the entire multi-thousand-acre Biltmore estate. Now, Princess Diana's brother, Charles Spencer, the 11th Earl of Spencer, was quite correct when he lamented in his eulogy that, quote, "Of all the ironies about Diana, perhaps the greatest is this, that a girl given the name for the ancient goddess of hunting was in the end the most hunted person of the modern age," end quote. That was a marvelously magical, almost musical turn of a phrase, which simultaneously punched the Midianites right in the nose, or right in the mouth, shall we say, and at the same time, it evoked even more sympathy for the beautiful Diana, who was cut down in the prime of her life at the age 36. In a manner of speaking, the world seemed to come to an end last Saturday. It came to a halt. Time seemed to stop as millions mourned in person and a billion more mourned in their living rooms in front of the television. The massive numbers of people, the millions who watched this sad spectacle on television, felt personally touched in some way by this woman, Diana, whose personal life was seldom allowed to be personal or private. It was a personal life that was marked for the most part by great unhappiness and full of trials and tribulations, despite all the wealth. Why did so many millions feel such a personal bond with a woman they had never met? What was it about her that endeared her to so many millions? The unprecedented worldwide phenomenon that was her funeral leads me to believe that there is more than just an ironic coincidence of names at work here. I'm inclined to agree with one of the Midianites' experts on royalty, David Starkey, who remarked that the outpouring of grief for Princess Diana could be likened to, quote, the invention of a religious cult, end quote. Will the death of Diana ignite a new religious cult, the cult of Diana? Realistically, the cult of Princess Diana was invented and ignited 16 years ago, as the media have followed her every move ever since. But it would not be surprising to me to see that she becomes even larger in death than she was in life. This is the process of how flesh and blood historical people become endued with god or goddess status as myths and legends are built up around them. For example, Odin is the name of one of the old German and Norse gods, and yet he was simply an historical figure. He was a man of great military talent who came from the area of Asia Minor called Cappadocia and went up through Germany doing tremendous military exploits and on up into Scandinavia. And he was a man of great military talent whose feats were embellished into myth centuries after his death so that he became, quote-unquote, a god. And so that even today, there are a very, very few, but occasionally very noisy, Aryan supremacists who actually worship Odin as their god. They are not Christians, of course, nor do they claim to be. But the point of mentioning that is that in times gone by, it would take many decades to even centuries for the historical figure to be enthroned in the pantheon of the gods. Ah, but nowadays, when we have everything from instant grits to instant replays, the Midianites can accelerate the process of elevating someone to goddess stature virtually overnight. And it seems like that's what's happening with Diana. At the funeral of Diana, one of the television reporters stated that the location of her grave had been changed from earlier in the week, from the family's ancestral burial plot in the town or village of Althorpe to inside the Spencer estate itself, where the expected crowds could be kept out for the ostensible purpose, quote, so that it would not turn into another Graceland, end quote. Y'all know what that is, right? I find that reference and comparison to Graceland quite interesting as well. Graceland is the name of the Elvis Presley mansion, now a museum, I suppose, where his grave is located in Memphis, Tennessee. And of course, we all know that Elvis is alive, right? How many of you have seen him, right? Just kidding. Now, what is all this except a joking reference to the fact that some people get so caught up or are still so caught up in Elvis worship that they have made him into a god, a resurrected god. They actually believe he is still alive. It's a blasphemous and pathetic parody of the resurrection of the one and only true God, Jesus Christ. And yet, changing the location of Diana's grave will probably have just the opposite effect of what they announced. In other words, it will probably go even further towards immortalizing her than if they had placed her in the ancestral family graveyard. If she was the people's princess, as they call her, and a world icon in life, what will she be in death? She will be elevated to goddess status. She's virtually there already. Turn to Acts chapter 19. Acts chapter 19. And as you do, I would dare say that the fact that her body has now been laid to rest on this tiny little island in the lake on that idyllic Spencer estate has predictably led some to begin to call her the Lady of the Lake, which is, again, a reference to the myths and legends, this one to the myths of King Arthur and Camelot, right? And so we find a mythological aspect already being accorded to Princess Diana. And in his tribute song to what he called England's Rose, Elton John refers to the legend of Diana, right? What does it say, the candle in the wind, the candle will blow out before your legend will ever die, or something like that. This has, all these things put together, all the makings of a genuine religious cult. It's off and running. Now, at Diana's two-hour funeral, could you not just hear the world hailing her, albeit silently, as, "Great is Diana of England! Great is Diana of the English!" But we see from here in the book of Acts, chapter 19, verse 34, that the cult of Diana is not new. It's a very ancient religious cult, and we read this in verse 34. "But when they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice, about the space of 2 hours, cried out, 'Great is Diana of the Ephesians!'" Where was the city of Ephesus? It was in Asia Minor, right? And those of us who know that we are the literal descendants of the Israel people know that over the centuries, many of those Israelites from Ephesus and from all over Asia Minor migrated northward and westward into and across Europe, mixing with the non-Israelite white people who were already in Europe, just as had been prophesied in the book of Hosea. And so we could say that eventually some of those whose forefathers had been Ephesians back at the time of Paul are now called English. And we had Diana of the Ephesians, now we have Diana of the English. Let me tell you about the ancient goddess Diana. First of all, Diana is the Roman name for this pagan deity. And as often happens when pagan deities are imported from one culture to another, some attributes remain the same and others are dropped and new ones are added. And so it seemed to be with Diana. She had a whole lot of attributes. We'll mention a few in a minute. Most sources identify Diana with the Greek goddess Artemis. And at the same time, she's said to be the twin sister of Apollo and the female counterpart of the Roman god Janus, J-A-N-U-S, from which we get our month name January. You see, Janus was a Roman god, and he was a two-headed god. One head looked backward and the other head looked forward. If you turn a side view, of course, you know, one's looking this way and one's looking that way. And that's why the first month of the year in the Roman calendar was named after Janus. One head was looking back at the previous 12 months and the other head was looking forward to the future, the new year. Now, in the Latin language, a word ending in U-S, like Janus, is masculine. To make the feminine counterpart of the word Janus, you drop the U-S and add the letter A, making Jana, J-A-N-A. And you can almost hear the very close similarity between Jana and Diana. We pronounce Diana with a hard D sound, but if you soften that D and say it real quickly with the letter I, you can hear how the name Jana, Diana, evolved into the modern pronunciation of Diana. Now, the scholarly sources tell us that Diana-Artemis was the equivalent of the Babylonian goddess Ishtar and of the Phoenician Canaanite goddess Astarte, whose male counterpart was Baal, or Baal. So we're talking about Baal worship here, really, aren't we? Being an amalgamation of earlier goddesses, Diana had numerous attributes. As you know from the Earl of Spencer, she was the goddess of hunting, but she was also the goddess of the moon, goddess of light, goddess of the plain, goddess of the rivers and of the bodies of water, and goddess of the hills and goddess of the forest. And she was the goddess of love and the goddess of childbirth. And she was one of, if not the major goddess of fertility. And this is how she was portrayed in biblical times, as Great Diana, goddess of the Ephesians. She was a fertility goddess, and some Bible dictionaries will show a picture of her statue, in which she has numerous breasts. In fact, she is covered literally from her shoulders to her waist with breasts. That was the fertility goddess. And this was the manner in which Demetrius and his cohorts here in Acts 19 manufactured the images of Diana in the city of Ephesus. Let's go ahead and read this passage now, shall we? It begins in verse 24 of Acts 19. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen, whom he called together with the workmen of like occupation, and said, Sirs, ye know that by this craft we have our wealth. So now here's a very clever demagogue named Demetrius, who makes his money by selling religious trinkets to tourists and visitors to Ephesus, which was the world center of worship for the great goddess Diana. In fact, her temple there was one of the ancient wonders of the world. It took 220 years to build the great temple to Diana in Ephesus. So it was the world center of worship, like the Vatican in Rome, the center of world Catholicism. But Demetrius here lays it on the line for his fellow trinket pushers that this Christian missionary named Paul is very bad for business. In fact, Demetrius persuades his buddies that they're all going to be out of business if they let these Christians keep on preaching. So we read in verse 26, Demetrius is still talking. Moreover, ye see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but almost throughout all Asia, this Paul hath persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. Verse 27, so that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. I have a sneaking suspicion that other than what Diana could do for his pocketbook, Demetrius really didn't give two hoots about this idol, this no-god named Diana. He was in it for the money, period. But he was certainly quick to use the city pride theme and the patron saint of Ephesus type of mentality argument on his fellow craftsmen in order to secure their cooperation in helping to persecute the Christians. Demetrius was doing whatever it took to protect the false religion and the cult of Diana, because if her cult worship were diminished or were destroyed by the gospel, well then he would be out of business. Now, there are a couple of lessons there which I will mention just briefly in passing. Number one, the most obvious lesson here is that we have the testimony of this pagan silversmith named Demetrius that the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ is overwhelming. That wherever the truth of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection is preached and taught, there we will find that false religions will melt away like ice cubes on a griddle. Secondly, we can see from this passage and are looking around today that the religious trinket business is alive and well. It thrives wherever false religions take root. Have any of you ever been to a Catholic shrine? I was raised Catholic, and some few of you have. You talk about the religious trinket business. Do you bear witness? Is that right? Yeah. I'm not just going to pick on the Catholics. I'm sorry to say that many Protestant organizations are just as bad, if not worse, in some ways. I'm thinking particularly about the hype and the hoopla surrounding many of the televangelists, especially those of the charismatic persuasion. This is not anything to do with charismatic theology. It's just that they're pretty prominent in this religious trinket business. You heard them, haven't you? For example, my dear brothers and sisters, all of you brethren watching me on television out there at this very moment, the Holy Spirit told me to pray over 5,000 linen cloths and make them available to our City Slicker Ministries viewers. My friend, if you are ailing, if you have a wart, if you have a hangnail, if you have lumbago, if you have a hangnail, an ingrown toenail, send today and request one of the specially anointed linen cloths that I have prayed over. And when you receive it, take it out of that specially made cardboard slipcase with our City Slicker Ministries logo embossed upon it. Take out that Holy Ghost anointed cloth and place it upon whatever part of your body is ailing you, and just praise Jesus for your healing. And those of you that need a financial blessing, you too should write us and request your special Holy Ghost anointed cloth. And when you receive it, you just place it over your checkbook and you praise God for your blessing. While I'm mentioning your checkbook, be sure to send us a love gift of $50 when you write and request your free Holy Ghost anointed linen cloth. Just make your check payable to City Slicker Ministries. And remember, your gift is tax deductible because we are an IRS 501c3 government approved ministry. Religious trinkets are indeed still religious trinket scams are still waxing rich after 20 centuries after Ephesus, right? Now, if we go back to verse 11 of this chapter, Acts 19, we read this: "And God wrought special miracles by the hands of Paul, so that from his body were brought unto the sick handkerchiefs or aprons, and the diseases departed from them, and the evil spirits went out of them." So obviously, God did work miracles by means of handkerchiefs and various cloths. And I believe that he could and perhaps does do such things today, even though I'm not personally aware of any recently. But if you think that our God is pleased with the modern Demetriuses, the trinket pushers, especially those Demetriuses who masquerade as ministers or televangelists, well, I think that must be a stench in his nostrils. Do you agree? Let's go back to verse 28 now and pick up the story. Demetrius has succeeded in his demagoguery. Verse 28. "And when they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, Great is Diana of the Ephesians. And the whole city was filled with confusion. And having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theater. And when Paul would have entered in unto the people, the disciples suffered him not. And certain of the chief of Asia, which were his friends, sent unto him, desiring him that he would not adventure himself into the theater. Some therefore cried one thing, and some another, for the assembly was confused, and the more part knew not wherefore they were come together." Typical mob psychology at work there, right? Verse 33, "And they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. And Alexander beckoned with the hand, and would have made his defense unto the people. But when they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice, about the space of 2 hours, cried out, Great is Diana of the Ephesians. And when the town clerk had appeased the people, he said, Ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not how that the city of the Ephesians is a worshipper of the great goddess Diana, and of the image which fell down from Jupiter? Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, ye ought to be quiet, and to do nothing rashly. For ye have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers of churches, nor yet blasphemers of your goddess. Wherefore, if Demetrius and the craftsmen which are with him have a matter against any man, the law is open and there are deputies. Let them implead one another. But if ye inquire anything concerning other matters, it shall be determined in a lawful assembly. Verse 40. For we are in danger to be called in question for this day's uproar, there being no cause whereby we may give an account of this concourse. And when he had thus spoken, he dismissed the assembly." Now, there are several other things worth noting in this passage. Notice the word assembly is used three times, in verse 32, verse 39, and verse 41. This is the Greek word ekklesia, which literally means called out ones. And of course, it's usually translated as what in our New Testament? Church. And I want to call it to your attention because there are some today who want to get away from the word church because perhaps of the centuries of abuse and war and violence and all manner of mischief and mayhem which have been done under the name of the church. And so one misguided minister out west decided he would never use the word church again to describe his group or his followers. He decided that they would be ecclesias and that they would build ecclesian communities. Well, the fact is, though, that in the New Testament, the word ecclesia does not refer exclusively to the Christian churches. And here's the proof right in this passage. In verse 32 and verse 41, the word assembly is ecclesia and refers to ungodly and a riotous group of rowdy idol worshipers. So in my opinion, using the word ecclesia instead of church is misguided. And it reminds me of what someone told me a long time ago. He said, James, if you ever run into the perfect church, don't join it. You'll ruin it. In other words, we're never going to find a perfect church, are we? Perhaps a more important lesson and observation to be drawn from this passage is in verse 37. Let's look at that again. For ye have brought hither these men which are neither robbers of churches. And that is not the word ecclesia, by the way. It's the word hiersoulos, which means robbers of temples. Very poor translation, unfortunately, in the King James there. Nor yet blasphemers of your goddess. So this man is saying, hey, these Christian missionaries, they didn't come in and rob your temples. They didn't come in and blaspheme Diana. And the main thing I want us to see here is the manner in which Paul and his co-workers did conduct themselves. They didn't come in and knock over the idols and rob the establishment, so to speak. I mean, the Diana cult was the establishment there, wasn't it, religiously speaking? I just read an article last week where this minister, I think he was from a mainline denomination church in New Jersey or somewhere like that. I don't remember exactly, but he was proclaiming that it was okay for people to steal from the large chain department stores, especially if the person was on welfare. Any of you hear about that?
No, I'm just
Now, he went on to say that the big Walmarts and the Kmarts were stealing from the people anyhow by putting people out of work, by having their goods made in Mexico and elsewhere, and by forcing the closure of smaller businesses because they couldn't compete. Well, all that may be true, but it's also true that two wrongs don't make a right, no matter how you cut it. So, secondly, Paul and his co-workers preached the gospel in a very hostile, very heathen environment. And yet they did it, apparently, without being insulting and without being offensive and obnoxious to those they were trying to convert. I don't know if this problem fits you individually. Well, maybe I do know about some of you. But I don't deem it my business to tell you unless you ask me. But I know this is a problem which is very widespread in the Christian Israel identity movement. And there's a lesson here for us, most of us anyhow, especially me. It's a problem which I myself was quite oblivious to for quite a long time. And you know why I was quite oblivious to it for such a long time? Probably because I was the chiefest of sinners in this regard. And even if I saw this behavior in others, I did not think there was anything wrong with it at the time. You know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about our attitudes towards the people we are trying to reach with what we perceive to be the truth. If we come across as obnoxious, arrogant, know-it-all, proud, holier-than-thou type missionaries for the Christian Israel truth, how many people are we going to persuade? or if not persuade them? How many of them are even going to be wanting to be around us, to listen to us anymore? And sometimes we walk away from a person we failed to reach, and we walk away thinking it's their fault. Oh, they just don't want to hear the truth. Maybe. Or maybe it was the attitude of the missionary. His manner is so insulting and offensive and obnoxious that the message is obscured. Now do you know what I'm talking about? I think most of us are familiar with that syndrome. Well, as I was saying, I can easily see it in others now. Why? Because I've been there. And I'm not claiming to be out of the woods. I'm not completely free of all those attitudes and behaviors yet. In fact, this is one of the biggest struggles that I have had in the past 4 or 5 years since it was pointed out to me. For me, it is really something I must continually work on and try to be aware of at all times. What is my attitude here? And do you want to know who first pointed this out to me? Did I hear that? My wife, yes. My dear wife. And I treasure her help in coaching me on how to do my job better. Because she can tell me things that I would never see in 100 years about myself. I mean, after all, I'm supposed to be a leader who is teaching and equipping others to be able to minister the word and to preach the gospel. Isn't it about time I learned this lesson? And so as I'm learning it, I'm going to pass it on to you folks. Now, my Christian brothers and sisters, and I'm speaking to those on our tape ministry as well, this lesson does not apply to every single one of you. Some of you are already kind and gentle and loving teachers of the word to those whom God has brought across your path. But for the rest of us, if the shoe fits, like myself, many of you have either forgotten or maybe never did learn how to put into practice what we were exhorted to do in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15, this portion of the verse where it says that we are to speak the truth in love. Oh, we don't seem to have any problem at all in doing the first part. We can speak the truth, can't we, that we've been shown. But oh, how difficult it is to put into practice those last two words. To share that truth in a humble, gracious, loving, kind, and gentle attitude. God grant us the grace. Well, the fairy tale of Diana ended. The story of Princess Diana is tragic in many ways. It is reported that on the day before their wedding, Prince Charles told Diana that he did not love her, that he loved Camilla Parker Bowles, or whatever her name was at the time, and that he was only marrying her for her to produce heirs to the throne. And this, can you imagine how that must have crushed this 19 or 20 year young woman's heart? And she asked her sisters, "Can I get out of this?" And they told her, "No, the towels are already printed with the royal emblems and all this kind of stuff." And she went on, of course. And you see, though, she and Charles were not strangers before he plucked her from the London kindergarten and married her. The Spencer estate is adjacent to one of the estates of the royal family. And as a young girl, Diana knew the royal family quite well. She was a neighbor and was a childhood friend and playmate with both Prince Andrew and Prince Edward, Charles' younger brothers. And Diana called the Queen Aunt Lilibet. Now, you got to be on pretty good terms to call the Queen of England Aunt Lilibet. So she was well acquainted with Charles from her childhood. Nonetheless, she married Prince Charming and bore him 2 sons. And she continued the royal charade of a marriage with Charles for as long as she could bear it. She had known of his unfaithfulness to her for a long time, and yet when he admitted it publicly, and then she admitted hers as well, which was supposedly in retaliation for his adultery, we saw a curious reversal of the story of the woman taken in adultery that we began the message with. Because in the case of Charles and Diana, we found that the public scorned Charles for his adultery, right? But seemingly, the public were sympathetic and willing to excuse that of Princess Diana. And so the charade ended in divorce almost exactly a year before the princess's death. But it seemed that the princess, in this last year, was just beginning to really find herself. Now, a moment ago when I told you about their estate being adjacent to the royal estate, or one of the royal estates, I didn't mean to paint a picture of her childhood as storybook ideal. It certainly was anything but. As a child, she endured the tragedy of her parents' divorce, and she never enjoyed a good relationship with her mother after that, if she had before. Although she was homeschooled for her early years, by about age 10, she was sent away to boarding school in southern England, and after that to a finishing school in Switzerland, which she never finished. But that's all par for the course for girls in the British aristocracy. But she grew up feeling very, very insecure and unloved. She was really too young by the time she married him to have found and established her own identity when she got caught up in that vortex of the royal marriage. And so when she was freed by divorce from the royal family a year ago, she began a new life. She began, in a way, to be England's unofficial goodwill ambassador. And Tony Blair even said he was going to even ask her to be some kind of official ambassador at large for England. She involved herself in numerous charities and other good works. And so perhaps she was at last finding herself. She was perhaps finding where her true talents lay, and she was finding herself, finding the real Diana by loving others less fortunate than herself, the untouchables, the lepers, those who had their limbs blown off by landmines, and even those dying of AIDS. She literally embraced them, didn't she? I found it more than fascinating that one encyclopedia article on the goddess Diana states that, quote, her amiable disposition caused her to alleviate suffering and to care for the diseased, end quote. And of course, yesterday was the funeral of Mother Teresa in Calcutta. And a lot of comparisons could be made between Diana and Mother Teresa. True, Diana did not care for the diseased in the same manner that Mother Teresa did. But then again, God gave Diana a totally different path down which to walk. And it would be very easy to be cynical about the good works of Diana. But let's give her the benefit of the doubt, shall we? Knowing two things. Number one, that God judges the thoughts and intents of the heart. And number two, that all the good works in the world will not merit a person eternal life. But we're not really focused here upon the issue of Diana's salvation. We're looking at the broader context of the meaning of her life and death. And so as she was finding her true self by giving love to the untouchables, I found it more than coincidence that at the funeral, British Prime Minister Tony Blair read the entire chapter of 1 Corinthians 13, Paul's great treatise on love. Love never fails. And I didn't look it up, but I would bet you 10-1 that is the word agape love, the unselfish giving love. Looking at this in a symbolic fashion, in a limited sense, Diana appears to represent at least a part of national Israel on a world scale. For one thing, we noted earlier the similarity to the Cinderella story, again in a limited sense. Most of us are familiar with the fact that the Cinderella story, along with almost all the other Grimm's fairy tales, were in reality disguised versions, stories of lost Israel. Looking at Diana from another perspective now, we must mention the unfortunate fact that in her last few months, Diana had apparently joined herself to a man named Dodi al-Fayyad. And speaking in types and symbols, Dodi al-Fayyad obviously represents the Egyptian connection. Dodi al-Fayyad was obviously a non-Israelite. Moreover, he was a Muslim, which is a false religion because it does not accept Jesus Christ as God manifest in the flesh. We have all heard that Dodi was the son of Muhammad al-Fayyad, who was a billionaire and who owned Harrod's department store in London, along with numerous other holdings. Did you know that Dodi's late mother, though, was the sister of Adnan Khashoggi, the very notorious, wealthy Saudi Arabian arms dealer?
I didn't
know that. Yeah, that's an interesting connection there, isn't it? Well, Time magazine described Fayyad, Dodi al-Fayyad, as, quote, an unreconstructed playboy, end quote. Although he reportedly received $100,000 spending money per month, Dodi apparently routinely bounced checks and left a string of unpaid bills, like $35,000 here and $20,000 there for renting the Beverly Hills mansion here and there. And just his favorite book was a little black book which listed his string of jilted lovers among the jet set crowd. In short, this man was the epitome of the corrupt world system and materialism, and thus the Egyptian connection. Now, in the Bible, Egypt symbolizes at least four things: bondage or slavery, the world system, sin, and death. And thus, on a symbolic level, Diana's connection with the Egyptian does not look good. As the old saying goes, she was looking for love in all the wrong places. Does she represent those of national Israel who do not yet know Christ? Or perhaps she represents those nominal Christians who know him only superficially and who are easily seduced back into bondage to the world system, which results in death. Just before they got into the Mercedes, it was that very evening that Dodi Fayyad had presented Diana with a ring valued at roughly $250,000, which was a token of his intentions to marry her. The ring was found at the accident site. So symbolically, as soon as Diana, Israel, was sucked into marriage commitment with Egypt, her life was snuffed out. She had made a pact with death. Returning to the idea of how gods and goddesses are created in the public psyche, the comparison of Diana to Elvis Presley in death is once again pertinent. Though perhaps some foolish pagan Americans may idolize Elvis Presley to the inane point of believing that he is still alive, it is common knowledge that he was laid to rest in a city called Memphis, which takes its name from the ancient city of Memphis, which was the capital of Egypt for at least two millennia in the BC period. It was the capital of Egypt. And thus, Elvis is identified with Egypt in his death, just as Princess Diana is identified with Egypt in her death. Two icons, two idols of the Israelite world are being swallowed up in death by Egypt, representing the world system and death. Another unfortunate fact surrounding the death of Diana is the part played by Elton John. Although there are a number of now quote-unquote Christian denominations which are openly ordaining and hence approving homosexuality, it does not shock us anymore to see an avowed homosexual, Elton John, playing a song at her funeral in Westminster Abbey, which is one of the oldest religious buildings in Christendom. We have witnessed idolatry now at its fullness, for Elton John is himself an icon to millions. For his part in the service, he took a song which he had originally written as a tribute to another tragic female figure, Norma Jean, aka Marilyn Monroe, and he altered the lyrics to eulogize, to glorify, to attempt to immortalize Princess Diana. And he did an excellent job, because with that powerful medium of music, the world is brought to tears. What is it about this tragic woman, Princess Diana, which can evoke such emotions, such idolizing, such idolatry among the masses of true Israel? Not to mention among the heathen. What is it about her? As one friend suggested to me, Perhaps it is because we as a people, Britain, America, Australia, all the other Israelite nations, we have, like our forefathers, again forsaken Yahweh our God, and we have returned to Egypt. We are in bondage, economic slavery to a world system. The Bible prophesied this would happen. Our deliverance would be after the manner of Egypt. And as a people as a whole, we refuse to obey God's laws, statutes, and judgments. And therefore, we are in rebellion to Him. And the Bible tells us that rebellion and idolatry are synonymous. We cannot worship God and mammon. Mammon is the world system. And thus we see the now virtually paganized Israel people who have idolized Princess Diana in her life. Pagan Israel has been living vicariously through following every move of Princess Diana. Pagan Israel has used the princess as Prozac. Following her life vicariously has numbed and dulled the senses so that the chains of our slavery to Egypt, to the world system, the chains don't feel so painful with Prozac. And yesterday I came across an article which states that the driver of the Mercedes limo was not only intoxicated 3 times the legal limit, and shall we say that in type he too fits the type because he was drunk on the wine of Babylon, Mystery Babylon. Not only that, though, his blood was found to have also contained certain drug chemicals, one of which was fluoxetine, if that's how you pronounce it, which is the main ingredient in Prozac. Now, I would not want to close on such a negative note, so let me share with you 2 facts, 2 tiny tidbits, which I think might have very great significance in the overall symbolism of this otherwise terrible, tragic event. Terribly tragic event. You see, Diana, being forced by the circumstances of her life to circulate in the jet set among other international icons, like those of pop music, those of high fashion and of Hollywood, Diana obviously made friends with many people in that set, and undoubtedly with some in the jet set whose morality is putrid to the core. She had been friends with both Elton John and Gianni Versace. Versace, you recall, was the high fashion designer, a homosexual, like most of them are, who was murdered in Miami in July by another homosexual. But it was reported that Diana had had a falling out with Elton John earlier in the year, but that she had reconciled with him at Versace's funeral. That's tidbit number one. Number two is that in the past few months that Diana is also reported to have forgiven Prince Charles, and that the two had recently been on much better terms with each other than they had ever been in their marriage. What's the significance of these 2 little items? Well, I think it's this. And let me introduce it by way of contrasting the apparent attitude of Diana near the end of her life with that of her brother Charles. Charles, the Earl of Spencer, used the occasion of his eulogy to her. He used that occasion as a bully pulpit. It was not simply a case of bad manners where he used that opportunity to lash out at the press and take pot shots at the royal family. It wasn't just bad manners on his part, for the eulogy was neither the time nor the place to criticize either the royal family or the press. But what I'm pointing out here is that in doing so, Charles Spencer betrayed his own heart bitterness. In fact, some of the media descriptions were talking about his bitter remarks, etc., etc. Now, for those of you who were here or on our tape ministry a year ago, you recall that we did 6 messages on the principle, the Bible principle of the Jubilee. Essentially, Jubilee means forgiveness. It's the basis of all grace in the Old and New Testaments. It's the opposite of heart bitterness, because one cannot forgive another when one has bitterness in his heart towards that other person. And I mentioned in those messages a year ago that there was a good possibility that this year, that is from the fall of 96 to the fall feasts of 97, just might be a very significant year, that it might be a very important year of Jubilee. And if that is the case, then I find it very significant that as we approach the close of this Jubilee year, that the death of this world icon, the people's princess, that Diana's death came shortly on the heels of her forgiveness of two of those who had wronged her, that we know about publicly. That makes a double witness. And thus her death serves as a bookend, a closing event to mark the conclusion of this year of Jubilee. She lived out the Jubilee principle, at least on those occasions. And returning to Elvis in Memphis once more, it's perhaps significant as well that Elvis is buried in the land of Jubilee. That is, he's buried in Graceland. So in closing, it's my prayer that Diana's exhibiting the Jubilee principle, I pray that that will be prophetic of the whole house of Israel learning to forgive and exhibiting the Jubilee principle. When we forgive, we will be forgiven. Do you think when we learn how to forgive, that God will forgive us and bring Babylon down? That's my prayer, to bring all Israel into the glorious liberty of the sons of God. Amen.